Welcome to the second hour's readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Ready for field day in a virtual way. Students have missed out on so much during this school closure, but ironically enough, the annual field day is not one of the canceled events. Ector County ISD PE coaches joined a national movement to host a virtual field day on from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday from Ratliff Stadium. Students will not be there, but coaches will be competing against each other and running a clock for timing events. Students and their parents and everyone in the community can join in the competition via YouTube Live on the ECISD Elementary PE channel. Over the past few weeks, coaches have provided activity cards to students with demonstrations of each field day activity. They have also created videos performing and setting up the activity. There are 29 home activities for students, staff, and families to perform, and coaches are asking kids to perform a minimum of 5 of them for field days. Coaches will send out scorecards for those who are competitive, and they will be available virtually throughout the day to help and watch families, teachers performing activities. Everyone is invited to send videos or pictures of their performances to their school's social media pages. Midland College plans for summer and fall. Midland College continues to operate virtually and online. The spring 2020 semester ended Friday, May 8th. MC will offer online courses during its Summer 1 session, June 1st to July 8th, and Summer 2 session, July 9th to August 14th. Instructional administrators and faculty are reviewing the fall 2020 course schedule to see how best to serve students while protecting health and safety. Plans are to extend online course offerings and provide some face-to-face courses and hands-on labs, especially in the Applied Technology and Health Sciences programs, a news release said. Current students should contact their advisors to schedule a phone or video conference in order to establish individual course schedules. Students may also email advising@midland.edu. New students should follow application and enrollment procedures located on the MC website at www.midland.edu/enroll or email enroll@midland.edu for answers to specific questions. MC's student services departments and administrative offices are observing summer operating hours of 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday, May 11th to August 6th. Current and prospective students can contact MC faculty, administrators, and staff via email. An online employee directory is available at www.midland.edu/directory. July runoff election requires voter registration. Those who wish to be eligible to vote in the joint primary runoff election July 14th must be a registered voter, according to the Ector County Elections Office. People who are not a registered voter or need to update their addresses with the voter registrar have until June 15th to do so in person or at least have the application postmarked by June 15th. People may also submit an application online with the Secretary of State at the following email addresses. For Ector County, www.co.ector.tx.us/default.aspx?ector county/elections. Midland County, www.co.midland.tx.us/328/elections-office and the Secretary of State at www.sos.state.tx.us. If voters are unsure of their voting status, they can contact the Ector County office at 432-498-4030 and the Midland County office at 432-688-4890. Permian High School cafeteria worker tests positive for COVID. A Permian High School kitchen staff member has tested positive for COVID-19. This team member worked last week and displayed no symptoms of the virus. The employee began feeling ill Friday night and has remained at home all of this week. In consultation with health officials and following all recommendations, the other members of the PHS kitchen staff have been sent home to self-quarantine for the next 14 days. The PHS facility has been cleaned and sanitized, and a new team of kitchen workers was put in place Thursday. This was the second kitchen staff member to test positive in the last week. The other cafeteria team member was at Gonzales Elementary School. She worked only inside the cafeteria and had no direct contact with families picking up meals. All district school nutrition workers, those inside as well as those outside on the serving line, are supplied with and instructed to wear the proper personal protective equipment and maintain social distancing during meal service, a previous news release said. ECISD could consider calendar changes. The Texas Education Agency is encouraging districts statewide to think differently about how to educate students next year, and one of those ideas would be to extend the school year and change the calendar. But Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray said there is no requirement. Mary said, any consideration of this is in the early stages right now. We're trying to wrap up this unusual school year and also make sure that our plans for the summer are in place. While we are doing all of that, we're exploring the possibilities for next year, and the calendar is certainly one of those things that we're considering, he added. In an email, a TEA representative said the agency is in constant contact with superintendents across the state about many issues related to the disruptions caused by COVID-19. School systems, students, and parents have been forced to rapidly adapt to a changed learning environment. One topic that's receiving a great deal of attention pertains to the school calendar. TEA is simply providing options for consideration that have been informed by our ongoing discussions. Ultimately, a local school board adopts calendars that they think will serve their students most effectively, the email said. For summer school, Mary said, the district knows it will be virtual. At this point, none of our kids will be attending any of our campuses. That could change slightly if the guidance from TEA and the state of Texas changes. But right now, it will be completely virtual, and we will have opportunities for all kids pre-K through 12th grade. Some students who would be considered at risk and are in need of some significant academic help will be the focus. But for all of our kids, we will have some enrichment opportunities, some engagement opportunities. Again, the content will be developed and shared for all of our students pre-K through 12th grade, Murray said. That is not required, of course, but it's important that our kids stay engaged in the learning process. It's important that their minds continue to work and to think all summer long so that we don't lose learning. The strategic plan that was put on pause in March doesn't have to be approved by the school board, but it will be on the board agenda next week in the form of a resolution of support for the plan. The board meets at 6 p.m. virtually. The plan is the work of the district, but the board establishes the goals. The strategic plan is really the how the employees of ECISD will organize themselves, the projects that we will do, the body of work that we're going to engage in to achieve those goals, Mary said. During their May 12th meeting, the board gave administration feedback on the plan. We will wrap it up and put a bow on it and roll it out to our community at an appropriate time. We had hoped to do this during the month of March, but then a virus got in the way. We have focused on recovering effectively from the virus before we roll out a strategic plan. I'm not sure, to be honest with you, that the community or even our own staff members are ready to hear about a strategic plan, Miri said. We're all really wrapped up in the mess that is happening today and in our community and our society, and we need to get past this process a little bit. We'll put the final adjustments on it and then kind of hold on to it and launch it in the next several months at the appropriate time when we feel the community is ready to receive it, he added. Part of the work in the plan is organizing to do the work necessary to effectively educate ECISD students. One of my favorite quotes is by Edward Deming. He doesn't always speak to education directly. He's very much a great business mind. One of his quotes is, "Your organization is perfectly designed to achieve the results that you're achieving." And when we look at our own organization, we have 4,200 employees that are engaged in the work of our organization. We do work every day, but are we organized to do our work effectively and efficiently? When you look at the results of our organization, some of the results that we have are not the results that we want for our kids. That tells us that we're not organized in a way that's going to maximize results for kids. So absolutely, we have to reorganize ourselves in a manner that allows us to do really good work for kids. Certainly, that is a part of this strategic plan, as it should be of any strategic plan. An effective organization organizes its people and its work to be effective and efficient, Mary said. Also during the board meeting, he gave some figures on remote student engagement. He said during a phone interview Wednesday that 89% of elementary students and 84% of our secondary students have been engaged. He said that data comes from week 3 and is from iStation reading software and Imagine Math. However, since that time, some students and families have become disengaged. We have some high school students that use those tools, but the high school level, we don't have applications that you typically find at the elementary and middle school because applications at the high school level are much more subject specific. So we do not have that same type of data using those same broad tools, Mary said. ECISD police officers have conducted more than 900 welfare checks. Some of those are simply because families have disappeared. The kids are no longer connecting with the school, and we need to make sure that those kids are safe. We need to make sure the families are safe, and we want to make sure that every kid remains engaged, Mary said. Of course, some of those visits are also because we have concerns about the safety of a child. And so they're doing welfare checks to check on the safety situation. Most of them are because we've lost contact with a child or a family, and we need to reconnect with them so that learning can continue. A recent Twitter post showed a number of books returned to the Education Foundation that were going to students and families to promote literacy. We know we have mobility challenges here. A family may leave one apartment complex and move to another and fail to leave a forwarding address. We have families who change their phone number on a regular basis, and therefore we lose contact. It's important that families share their contact information and keep it updated with the schools so we can remain in contact with them. Murray also recently noted that ECISD received a $300,000 grant from Raise Your Hand Texas for blended learning. An example of blended learning would be a teacher working with a small group of students while another group of students is engaged in their learning process using the tools of technology. It doesn't have to be kids are learning virtually at home while some kids are learning face-to-face with a teacher at school, Murray said. Blended learning happens best in a classroom environment or in the school setting in which a teacher is working with a small group while other kids are using other tools of technology to engage in learning. We call that model a station rotation model of blended learning. Kids are basically rotating through different stations in a classroom, and part of their time is with a teacher and part of their time is with technology. That's blended. He said research has shown it's effective. It allows us to leverage some of the challenges we face in our own environment. It allows us to serve more kids in a blended space. It allows a teacher to have more personalized opportunities with kids, Murray said. The district is considering whether to continue ECISD at home, the educational programs on the CW and Telemundo during the summer. The latest conversation we've had is, do we want to continue it in the summer? It's all about meeting the needs of our kids, and if our kids and families are finding it useful and it helps in the learning process, then it's something that we need to continue. If it is not effective and not helpful, then it's something that we do not need to do. But right now, we've clearly seen it has been well received by students and parents, and therefore we're going to continue it in some form throughout the summer. Then we'll reevaluate it as we see what school is going to look like for our kids in the fall, and we'll make a decision as to whether we need to continue it then or not, Murray said. Odessa College Testing Center achieves national status. Odessa College's testing center was recognized for setting the bar high for other post-secondary test centers and achieving national status as a leader in excellent testing practices in a press release from the National College Testing Association. According to the release, Odessa College Testing Center has been recertified by the National College Testing Association. Criteria for certification are rigorous and are based on the NCTA professional standards and guidelines, which were developed to guide post-secondary test centers in the delivery of quality testing programs. Odessa College Testing Center is one amongst a growing number of test centers in the U.S. and Canada to have completed this intensive recertification process. This recertification will be in place for 5 years and can be renewed by demonstrating continued compliance to national standards, a news release said. Congratulations are extended to Adriana Moreno and the entire staff at the Odessa College Testing Center for maintaining high test administration standards and for providing excellent service to a wide variety of students and community leaders in the performance of their duties, the release said. Contact the Odessa College Testing Center at testing@odessa.edu or call 432-335-6620 for more information about the numerous testing services provided, or go to the website at www.odessa.edu. Man charged with sexually assaulting stepdaughter. An Ector County Sheriff's Office affidavit detailed a 32-year-old man was arrested after he sexually assaulted his stepdaughter for about 15 months. Samuel Ivan Barron was charged with continuous sexual abuse of a child, victim younger than 14, a first-degree felony. The reported sexual abuse occurred from May 1, 2018 to August 29, 2019, the ECSO affidavit stated. August 29, 2019, deputies were reportedly dispatched to Ector College Prep Success Academy, located at 809 West Clements Street, as an eighth-grade female student made an outcry of sexual abuse. The girl was 13 years old at the time of the outcry. The girl was given a forensic interview at Harmony Home, where she stated her stepfather, identified as Barron, had sexually assaulted her multiple times between May 1, 2018 and August 29, 2019, the affidavit stated. The girl said the sexual abuse made her uncomfortable and scared. She reportedly told her mother, identified as 33-year-old Amber Torres, of the sexual abuse, but Torres didn't believe her, so she didn't report it. During an interview, Torres denied knowing that Barron had touched her daughter inappropriately, the affidavit stated. Torres stated her daughter did tell her Barron touched her inappropriately, but it was after the incident had been reported. Barron was reportedly interviewed, and he stated during the time the girl lived with him, he had seen her naked multiple times, and she had seen him naked several times. He didn't elaborate on any of the incidents. Barron stated that it was never brought up. Throughout the interview, Barron denied any sexual contact with the girl, the affidavit stated. He was booked into the Ector County Law Enforcement Center Tuesday, jail records show. He had one bond totaling $75,000 and posted bail Wednesday. Obituaries for Friday, May 15th. Laurie Lynn Blair. Laurie Blair passed away Sunday, May 10th. She was born April 16, 1959, in Atlanta, Georgia, to William Lewis and Jean Lewis. She is survived by her four children and two daughters-in-law, Rachel Bush, Matthew and Allison Blair, Mark Blair, and Jacob and Isabella Blair. She is also survived by her seven grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her parents, William Lewis and Jean Lewis. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send family condolences, please sign her guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. John G. Bethune. John G. Bethune of Odessa passed away May 12th. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Monday, May 18th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home Chapel with the Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell officiating. John was born December 14th, 1930 to John and Bertha Bethune in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He is preceded in death by his wife, Alice Davis Bethune. And is survived by his eight children, Jack Bethune, David Bethune, Karen Pearl, Naomi Gross, Lois Huffine, Rose Brundage, Timothy Bethune, and Robert Bethune, numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren, three brothers, Glenn Bethune, David Bethune, and Paul Bethune, and sisters Betty, Peggy, and Darlene. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. To send family condolences, please sign his guestbook at www.sunsetodessa.com. Death Notice. May Sims Kinchlow. May Sims Kinchlow, 69, of Midland, died Wednesday, May 13th. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, May 11th, 2020. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Terms of Engagement with China Have Changed, by Kathleen Parker, Washington Post Writers Group. Thanks to a tendency to project our own values onto other countries, many Americans mistakenly assumed that China would become more like us as it embraced a free market. This assumption has guided U.S. policy through several administrations, despite growing evidence that China never had any such intention. Nothing says reality check like a deadly pandemic, a national quarantine, a collapsing global economy, and little or no cooperation from the country where the virus got its start. The novel coronavirus has helped us and our international partners to finally see the communist nation's malign instincts. Though the virus originated in China, the government there denied American officials access to essential health data or to reveal patient zero. It has yet to provide a live virus sample or allow outside investigators in. China has underplayed its infection and death rates, thus skewing data and handicapping researchers trying to solve the mystery of COVID-19. As with any unhealthy relationship, it's worth considering our role in getting here. Ever since President Richard Nixon opened relations with China nearly 50 years ago, we've wanted engagement even at the expense of American values. We've not been demanding enough on human rights, starting with the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre. We downgraded our relationship with our longtime friend Taiwan on the condition that the, quote, Taiwan question, unquote, would be resolved peacefully to normalize relations with Beijing. And we minded our own business during China's one-child policy, which led to forced abortions and 30 million bachelors. Meanwhile, as codependents of a sort, we've happily allowed China to become an economic and military superpower while we fattened ourselves on cheap imports, washed down with the elixir of naive faith in the irresistible allure of democratic principles. Perhaps young nations like ours shouldn't presume to outmaneuver 4,000-year-old cultures through flirtation and flattery. By now, even Donald Trump's critics may be willing to concede that he was right on this one. If he was elected partly to end China's unfair trade practices, his re-election could depend on how successfully he navigates the China pandemic problem. There is little doubt that the White House has been deploying anti-China rhetoric lately, seeking to blame China for the coronavirus as a key piece of its re-election strategy. It's a fact, nevertheless, that China has a record of releasing viruses upon the rest of us, including H1N1 and SARS. As a strategic response, the Trump administration may be gearing up for a broader anti-China campaign in coming weeks and months. But this new strategy doesn't seem to be so much about the administration changing course. It's about how changing how the rest of us regard the Middle Kingdom. A top administration official with whom I recently spoke said this attitudinal reset will require both a re-education of the public, which sounds slightly Chinese-ish, as well as a mindset shift at universities and corporations, many of which are deeply invested in China and therefore in the success of the Communist Party. Some universities, for example, are heavily dependent upon Chinese students who pay full tuition. Many schools don't realize, the official said, that they're helping the Communist Party. At the same time, the Chinese government exerts outsized influence on American financial institutions because of its control of capital flows throughout the world. In a speech last October before the Hudson Institute, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo mention business conversations he has had with American business leaders who heavily invested in China were forced to comply with China's terms. In the Trump administration's views, American firms are being forced to choose between profits and human rights. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has steadfastly championed democracy and human rights in China since Tiananmen, understands this, the official suggested. We can't have different standards for them. The official suggested the U.S. would be taking other diplomatic steps soon to keep a closer eye on Beijing. I don't doubt it, but I asked the official whether this supposedly new American resistance to China's authoritarian methods might provoke an unwanted response. The official cautioned that Washington did not want a confrontation with Beijing. He said this in a number of different ways. We aren't backing China against the wall. We do not consider China an adversary, but rather a competitor. We prefer engagement. It's not about blame, but about prudence. He seemed to think the Chinese would match prudence with prudence, saying when China is challenged, it backs down immediately. Whether that's so, we're likely to find out. But such thinking does remind one of exactly the sort of they'll think like us thinking that got us in trouble in the first place. This column is entitled Advertising Drought Impacts News Outlets by Eric Wemple, Washington Post. U.S. News and World Report on Thursday apprised staffers that it is instituting 90-day furloughs across the company's divisions as the coronavirus advertising drought takes a toll on the news and data outlet. They were extremely difficult decisions to make, but we and the entire senior leadership team firmly believe they are necessary and proportionate to the reality we face as a business and as an industry, said the company's management, including Chief Executive Bill Holober, in an email to employees. The cost-cutting measures affect somewhere between 10 and 15% of U.S. News's roughly 320 employees, according to sources. And they're the second round of austerity measures since coronavirus hit the media economy. In late March, U.S. News management announced a round of tiered pay cuts ranging from 1% to 20%, the latter for employees making north of $150,000 a year. Top officials at U.S. News declined to comment for this story. Due to the unprecedented disruption caused by COVID-19, no industry has been untouched by this global crisis, including the entire media landscape. Per U.S. News and World Report's policy, we cannot comment any further or discuss personnel matters, reads a statement from a company spokesperson. The company wouldn't even provide basic information, such as the number of U.S. News employees, which sources place at about 325. An April 8th letter from more than 40 staffers petitioned the company for greater transparency in its dealings with employees during coronavirus. We request greater transparency around the company's financial situation and what we might expect in the coming months, read the letter in part. The theme of transparency emerged again on Thursday as many staffers learned of the furloughs, not from a company announcement, but from employees who had been advised that they themselves had been furloughed. The email from management came later in the day. Sources told the Washington Post that managers had hailed 2019 as one of the company's banner years, thus creating an expectation among staffers that U.S. News could withstand the coronavirus hit. In a 2018 interview, U.S. News editorial director Brian Kelly said that the publication was ditching conventional Washington coverage in favor of the melange of editorial projects that enabled the company to survive the collapse of the News Weekly business model. Once a leg in the trio of major U.S. News Weeklies, Time and Newsweek being the others, U.S. News bailed on print in 2010 and poured its resources into spin-off products. These days, it produces an array of rankings and policy coverage in areas including healthcare, education, travel, and real estate, among others. It ranks colleges, graduate schools, hospitals, places to live, states, what have you. Management has issued no apologies for veering from the cowpath of Washington journalism. The combination of data, reporting, analysis, and storytelling is resonating with a broad range of readers and advertisers, and setting us apart from the increasingly commoditized and financially troubled marketplace of ordinary news, reads a 2018 management memo issued as the publication abandoned its policy section. Nowadays, financially troubled describes a cross-section of media outlets, as each day of the coronavirus crisis brings more reports of companies that are experimenting with some mix of furloughs, pay cuts, and layoffs. The list includes BuzzFeed, Vox Media, McClatchy, Fortune, Sports Illustrated, The Hill, The Advocate, and too many others. The New York Times reported last week that roughly 36,000 workers at news companies had suffered furloughs, pay cuts, and layoffs. A common denominator for these shredded organizations is reliance on advertising. 80% of news publishers report having ad campaigns canceled since the scourge, according to a recent advertising study. Part of the problem is that advertisers themselves have been rocked by the deepening economic crisis, and another wrinkle is that many of those that remain flush don't necessarily want their products positioned alongside grim COVID-19 news stories. Revenue at U.S. News derived heavily from advertising, according to Kelly's 2018 comments. The company didn't answer a question from the Post about just how much. As it's been widely reported, it will take time for the economy to return to pre-COVID levels, if at all, and we are not sure which revenue streams, including advertising, will come back to prior levels, reads the Thursday email from management. The business environment is deteriorating faster than anyone could have imagined, and that is why we implemented further cost-saving actions. This column is called Guest View. How school will and must operate when doors reopen, from the San Antonio Express News. San Antonio Independent School District Superintendent Pedro Martinez makes a good case for school districts starting the fall semester sooner rather than later. But before parents can be convinced, they will need reassurances their children will be safe, and that will require parents and school administrators to work closely to develop an acceptable back-to-school plan. In a Zoom meeting with the Express News editorial board earlier this week, Martinez said students at SAISD will be heading back to campus August 10th. That's 14 days before the state's uniform start date. The Texas Education Agency allows school districts with certification as districts of innovation, such as SAISD, to begin their fall semesters early to reduce summer learning loss. The semester then ends before the traditional winter break. Martinez said concern about the COVID-19 learning slide likely will prompt his colleagues in local school districts to request permission from TEA to begin their school years earlier too. He also emphasized the importance of school as a safe place for students with an internet connection and meals provided, as well as the need for parents to return to work. And he expressed concern about a double whammy of COVID-19 and flu in the late fall, potentially prompting another round of campus closures and disruption. In his hour-long conversation with the editorial board, Martinez laid out some of the plans for bringing the 48,600 students in this inner-city district back to class. He is well aware some parents will be reluctant to allow their children to leave the safety of their homes in the midst of a pandemic, and he plans to offer options on where students can attend class and how education is delivered. In a perfect world, all children would have a nurturing home life. Access to distance learning would not be a problem. Parents would have the option of working from home, allowing them to continue homeschooling their children with the support of the school district if they so choose. The reality is many children are being left behind. We have a gaping digital divide in this city. Some homes have no internet access, some children lack a space to study and don't have the parental support they need with their schoolwork. Many parents can't return to work if their kids are not in school. There's no way you can bring tens of thousands of employees back to work if the schools are not open. You need childcare. You need children to be in a safe space, Martinez said. Martinez envisions a blended education model that will include classroom instruction and distance learning when the new school year begins. It could include school attendance and half-day shifts or on alternate days to reduce congestion on campus. Some of this blended distance learning might occur on campus. While some students would be with their teachers, others would work remotely in, say, a cafeteria or a gym to limit class sizes while also keeping students at school. Lunch will likely be served in classrooms instead of cafeterias. School buses will have limited capacity for transporting students to ensure social distancing. He wants to work with the business community so parents are allowed flexibility in their work schedules and already is soliciting feedback from parents. Getting the community involved in the planning for the reopening of schools is a good strategy for all districts. Change is never easy, but the pandemic requires it. We encourage all families with school-age children to enroll their students for the next school year and investigate the education options available through their school district, even if they are not ready to commit to having their students back on campus. There could be opportunities to continue distance learning at home, but enrolling for the next school year is critical because it allows districts to provide instructional services and equipment that can be utilized remotely. It also ensures continued state funding. On that front, we encourage TEA to extend attendance waivers so school districts do not lose any of that state funding as they grapple with this unprecedented crisis. Texas public education has made great strides in improving high school graduation rates and establishing a college-going culture. And it has been well on its way to increasing the number of Texans who earn a college degree or certificate. We cannot allow COVID-19 to undermine those efforts.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, May the 10th, 2020. Letters to the Editor. RRC failed to protect oil companies. The Texas Railroad Commission has shirked its duty to protect Texas oil and gas by refusing to initiate proration. Chairman Wayne Christian of the RRC wants to let the free market work to help small oil companies. Unfortunately, oil is not in a free market. Like the trusts of the early 1900s, the largest producer can determine the market. Saudi Arabia and Russia flooded the market in early March, driving oil prices to unbelievably lows. Those low prices may well bankrupt many small oil producers in the Permian Basin, forcing them to fire their entire staffs. When the largest producers control the market, is it a free market? Now the world is awash in excess oil because Saudi Arabia and Russia opened the valves in order to control the market and squeeze out high-cost American oil. By instituting proration, oil companies that produce more than 1,000 barrels a day would have to choke back production by a set amount determined by the RRC. Large oil companies would be affected, as well as medium-sized producers. Drilling for oil takes large amounts of money. That means smaller companies might need to have large bank loans for those endeavors. When prices fall so sharply in such a short time, people can't pay their loans and their collateral, that is, the wells, become worth a lot less. Banks can call in the loans and the company can't pay. Bankruptcy results, just what Saudi and Russia wanted. Lowering production using proration would have taken some of that overflowing oil off the market, forcing higher prices. The Texas Railroad Commission was derelict in its duty on Tuesday when it left oil companies to twist so slowly in the wind. Signed, David Rosen. Little things make a difference. My father said to notice the little things that make a big difference. So during my isolation fatigue, I wanted to recognize those fellow Midlanders who have used creativity and ingenuity to produce meaningful memories at little expense. Drive-by parades, including an Easter parade for St. Luke's UMC members. Yard cards, including messages of hope at Hillander and other schools. Sidewalk art by children and professionals, and visits beyond the glass at nursing homes by therapy pets and families are some of the outdoor activities that make me smile. Additionally, I'm proud of seamstresses who are making masks with leftover fabrics, folks with the 3D printers who are making straps to connect earpieces of those masks, as well as PPE shields at the planetarium, and those who pasted photos to church pews for weddings and services. Finally, the porch concerts, impromptu noisemaker events, kids' letters to senior citizens, and principals' visits with graduates are also little things that have made a big difference. So while our healthcare workers, first responders, postal employees such as Paul Rubio, restaurateurs and Easy Rider bus drivers have continued to work under these adverse circumstances, I applaud the rest of you for social distancing, but not social indifference. Signed, Iris Foster. Remember, runoff is in July. Remember that election we had in March? The judgeship for the 142nd District Court still has to have a runoff election. It was scheduled for May 26th, but now our new elections administrator, Carolyn Graves, tells me the governor has scheduled the runoff for July 14th. Keep it in mind. Put it on your calendar and join me in voting for David Rogers to be the new judge of that court. Signed, Al Walford. Retired judge.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Sunday, May 10th, 2020. Letter to the editor. Do the math on COVID. Taking the suggestion of a Jeff Davis County official in his April 9th opinion letter, I thought I'd do the math. I'd like to share with your readers numbers based on CDC info of recent annual influenza episodes compiled for a comparison to the CDC info given for the Wuhan flu crisis. The numbers are percentages based on the U.S. population of 329 million. Each case number was rounded for a percentage of infections and deaths. Influenza, April 2018. 14% of Americans infected, and 0.019% died. April 2019, 11% of Americans infected, and 0.01% died. April 2020, 14% of Americans infected, and 0.014% died. Wuhan virus, April 2020, 3% of Americans infected, and 0.02% died. Asterisk. These numbers are disputed due to infections and deaths that could have been attributed to other causes. The majority of the Wuhan flu infections and deaths were in the Northeast, more so in New York City, where they can be attributed to lifestyle as much as the Wuhan virus itself, due to things like overcrowding, high transient activity, and loose sexual habits. This brings us to the question of why dubious political actions used to control the East Coast crisis were used in many places to include rural Texas, where numbers were much lower and in some cases non-existent. We should pose this question to officials local, state, and federal. The one-size-fits-all approach, and the explanation many will give for it, is they were concerned about our health and safety. The question will then be, why weren't similar actions taken during the previous influenza and other virus events that infected many more and killed as many. The obvious fact remains that house arrest without due process is illegal at every level and in every jurisdiction. A recent statement by the U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr also raises these questions. If a state or local ordinance crosses the line from an appropriate exercise of authority to stop the spread of COVID-19 into an overbearing infringement of constitutional and statutory protections, the DOJ may have an obligation to address the overreach in federal court. The elections are coming soon. The answers, evasions, or non-answers given by officials should help to decide who not to vote for in the 2020 elections. Don't be afraid to call on officials with these questions, and always remember, to fear those in political power only serves to make them stronger and we the people weak. James R. LeBlanc, Fort Davis.
Hello, this is Michael reading To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach from the Odessa American, Friday, May 15th. Pneumonia vaccine is still a good idea. Dear Dr. Roach, many seniors like myself have received pneumonia shots within the past 5 years. Since the flu and coronavirus can result in a form of pneumonia in a severe case, would these shots be helpful to prevent or treat this virus even slightly? If seniors are most vulnerable, then maybe those who may not have received these shots should. Is my conclusion too simple? Answer. Pneumonia is a term for an infection of the lung. There are many different causes. The pneumonia vaccines, Prevnar, PCV13, and Pneumovax, PPSV23, protect against the most common bacterial cause, Streptococcus pneumoniae, also called pneumococcus. Unfortunately, it does not protect against the lung infections caused by viruses, like influenza or coronavirus. However, a bad viral infection, especially flu, can put a person at high risk for pneumonia. Post-flu pneumonia has a very high mortality rate, and many, but not all, are caused by pneumococcus. So I agree with you that anyone over 65, and many people with chronic heart or lung conditions, even if under 65, should get vaccinated against pneumonia. Dear Abby, for Friday, May 15th, 2020. Wife resists husband's plan to cut ties. Dear Abby, my mother-in-law is the worst. She has no respect for me. She has stolen, lied, and gossiped about me numerous times. Each time, I chose to forgive and move on. Recently, my husband made clear that he wants to cut ties with his mother and siblings because they constantly belittle his success and ask to borrow money. My problem is, I can't agree to it. I despise his mother, but I was raised to believe families should never sever ties. I believe every family has its ups and downs. My husband and I constantly argue because I continue to communicate with his mother and extend invitations to her. Abby, I just want to do the right thing, but I can't seem to figure out what the right thing to do is. SOS in Guam. Dear SOS, your husband's family is a threat to your financial stability and emotional health. Unless you want continuing discord in your marriage, respect your husband's wishes. Recognize that his family is extremely dysfunctional and do as he asks. If you don't, the arguments will escalate until they damage your relationship with him. Dear Abby, after being in a bad marriage for 40 years, I finally left my husband in 2011. After 2 years of separation and therapy, we reconciled. During the time I was gone, he leaned on his longtime friends for support and shared lots of personal information about me, some of which was untrue. The other evening, while we were having dinner and drinks, a mutual friend and I were talking about health, and I told him I was hiding a certain hip problem from my husband. He asked why, because my husband had told him about it years ago. I can't imagine why. The reason I left was my husband's anger at me over a hospital emergency room bill. I told this friend that my husband's concern for my health is not sincere, because he had recently blown up at me for mentioning an upcoming doctor visit. I am on Medicare. Now I'm worried that I may have wrecked their friendship by revealing how uncaring a husband he really is. How did I get here? Questioning myself. Dear questioning, how did you get here? You got here by remarrying a man who has such a big issue with spending money on health. If you stay with him, it could be catastrophic. Dear Abby, I was taught at home and in school to speak first when entering a room, a building, etc. However, my wife's family doesn't practice this. Recently, her sister, upon entering a room I was in, failed to speak first. After I said hello, she said, "I was wondering when you were going to say something." Are there etiquette guidelines that speak to this situation? Entering in the East. Dear entering, if there is a rule about who should speak first, I confess I have never heard of it. I know that it is proper for a woman to extend her hand first in a social situation if she wants to observe the formality, but that's as far as it goes. When it comes to who says hello first, common sense should rule. Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or your favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.